You're listening to Crazy Words, Crazy Tune on Community Radio WRFI in the Finger Lakes of New York State. My name is Roger Kimmel Smith, and I'm talking with Ian Nagoski, the record reissue artist whose Canary Records label specializes in re-releasing out-of-print recordings of world music from the early 20th century. You can find and listen to the whole Canary catalog at canary-records.bandcamp.com.
All right. Well, so now on your playlist, you've also selected a couple of tracks that that fall outside the usual temporal parameters that that I set, you know, for Crazy Words, Crazy Tune. And as this opens up the question I wanted to ask about, you know, our prior conversation has seeded it that we have a sort of narrow consensus American notion of things, including things in the past. And I think I've depended on that understanding to be able to communicate something by saying the 20s and 30s, right? Music of, that mm-hmm. time. But now I'm thinking like the historians have this concept of the long 19th century. It goes all the way from the French Revolution to the First World War. You know, let's call that one thing, mm-hmm. long 19th century. We perhaps have, we could say a long interwar period is captured when you say the era of the 78 RPM recording, you know, and you imply a sort of different global framework through that technology. What do you think? Does that sound sensible?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And, you know, life is, you know, if you're lucky long enough that, you know, one would, as a performer, not have a career that simply spanned 5, 10, 15, 20 years, but longer than that. If you were a serious musician, you would go on and on. And so the first performance that I sent to you of this next group was by somebody who had a very long, very complicated career. He was, in fact, one of the first 10 Arab performers to ever make records in the United States. He began recording in the U.S. in 1916 at the first recording sessions where any Americans recorded music in Arabic at Columbia Record Studios in the Woolworth Building, just like Panosian, just like Marika Papagika, right?
Okay.
His name is Naim Karakand. Mm-hmm. He's a wonderful violin player from Aleppo, Syria.
Okay.
He arrives in the U.S. and began teaching violin in Brooklyn, where he settled. He was extremely in demand. He accompanied on at least hundreds, potentially thousands of records made during the period between 1916, 1925, thereabouts, when it was the big flourishing of Arab-American records. Very active on the scene in what's called Little Syria, where there were, in fact, two independent labels started in the early 20s. Alexander Malouf and A.J. Maksoud both ran indie 78 companies in Little Syria in the early 20s.
Yeah, I mean,
and
Malouf performs, is another one of these really interesting characters you've exposed, but go on.
Yeah. Well, he's a hybridizer. Anyway, Karakand is the violin player on practically all of those records. Mm. You know, tons and tons of stuff. And he has this very complicated career in that he is enormously respected, winds up going to Brazil for a little while to his brother's wedding. But half of the Syrians who went to North America settled in North America, about half of them settled in South America.
Okay.
Anyway, so he goes there. While he's there at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, mm-hmm. when he's not even in the country, there's a festival of his compositions in 1937. He's not even in the country. And, you know, because people loved him that much, he has a very brief career in Hollywood. He's a music advisor on a number of Hollywood films, including Mata Hari, starring Greta Garbo. Anyway, then he comes back in the 1940s and 50s. He's on the radio all the time through the, you know, 30s and stuff. And he's performing at all these community events, haflas and stuff, with all of the other big performers. It so happens that a couple of years ago, I was put in touch with a guy named Ray Naba, who, when he was a teenager in New Jersey, started going to these community events with a tape recorder that he was gifted, and just set up a tape recorder and just ran it and recorded all these musicians performing in Passaic, New Jersey. And he and I got in touch. He knew I loved the music, and he started sharing these with me. And I started doing restoration of them and putting them out on Canary as these incredible, like, can you believe it's miraculous that these tapes still exist of Arab American folk music, basically performed live in real time with real audiences actually reacting the way they did. And you get daytime performances with kids running around. You get nighttime performances with drunk uncles yelling inappropriately and being shushed by other people.
Okay. So, but obviously not commercially recorded.
No, just literally, and no attention, just a microphone stuck next to a speaker, and then you walk away from it with the tape recorder running, right? That's it. It's just a
bootleg.
Because bootleg, but for private use, because he was interested in the music and wanted to learn to play it. So he's using it as a tool. Meanwhile, remember, this is during a period where immigration is basically shut down. And touring musicians are coming from the Middle East to play for the community periodically, and it's a big deal. And records are being physically imported from the Arab world. But all you basically have are the musicians who are second generation or first generation who are getting to be older now. This is a recording of what's called a taksim, an improvisation. That's the opening of a show by Naeem Karakhan, when he was playing with a guy from Boston named Anton Abdelahad. And it's recorded there live in New Jersey in... actually, after Karakhan's whole recording career had ended in the early 1960s, he's still performing. He's then about 70-something years old. He plays it. Plays it. So good. This immigrant born 1890 from Aleppo, who is one of the greatest violinists that America ever saw, and who has been, let's face it, completely forgotten. I love him.
Not completely.
It's like six guys. There's like 6-10 guys who know him and care about him. I'm one of those.
Yeah, but listen to these tapes.
He's great. He's really good. All right, so then there's one more of these Arab American records that I thought would be worth sharing with you, if only because it is local and indigenous to where you are.
Okay.
This is a record made in Utica, New York.
Utica, New York.
Yes. So
where the Syncopated Times newspaper is still published.
Is that right?
Yes, it is.
Ah, interesting. All right. Well, you may or may not have run into Sammy Shaheen, who was from Utica, was born in Utica in 1918, worked at a grocery store that his family ran. He was the second of nine kids. They were from Mount Lebanon, northern Lebanon. It was still greater Syria at the time. They got out right before the First World War. You may know that Lebanon had the largest per capita death toll during World War I. Half the population starved to death during the 1915, 16, 17. So they made it out and they settled in Utica. And he, eldest son, you know, second eldest, works at the grocery store, doesn't really have a music career until he's 30 years old, tours all over the place, makes a bunch of records, self-releases an LP in 1961. At the end of the LP, he includes a 2-minute track of his uncle. Tonis Barad is his name. It's one of only two recordings of this guy, his uncle, who was his music teacher, made in Utica, playing an instrument called a mijuiz. Mijuiz is like crumhorn, shawm, double reed instrument, very loud for dance. So this is an actual party record. I believe it recorded live, as a matter of fact. And just a little tribute that Shaheen gave to his beloved uncle to get his work out there in the world. Very unusual for this instrument to have been recorded in the United States, never mind your neck of the woods. So I'm very fond of this. So anyway.
Here, let me send you in another direction. Canary put out three or four albums of sort of polka-based Eastern European music, 20s and 30s, and it seems like it was all recorded in the US by Polish bands or by Ukrainians. And
Yeah, and Slovaks, and the whole business of Slavic music in the United States, those records are in heaving, groaning masses where I live. I mean, Poles and Ukrainians made and bought records just in enormous quantities. Okay, so the big wave of immigration to the United States between 1880 and 1920, that 40-year period, largest wave of immigration in U.S. history per capita until the present, as a matter of fact. Now, among that giant wave, about a third of those people who came were from southern Italy, basically. A third of them were from Eastern Europe. So Poles, Ukrainians, Slovaks, Czechs, other places in that. The intersection between three empires, the Russian Empire, Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Prussian Empire, the German Empire. Right where those three intersect, there's this territory in the middle of which is the Carpathian Mountains, where there are now nine different countries in what would have been that region, roughly, right? So tons of those people come over. They're being brought largely to work in all of these difficult industries. They're going into factories, they're going into mines, and there's just lots of them, and they're just working the steel mills and all this stuff. So yeah, the
And a
America
certain
fills up with,
percentage are Jewish, right?
and right, and there's Ashkenazi Jews among the folks who are coming in that wave, but there's a lot of skis, a lot of skis, a lot of skas. My wife, her people were sort of Poles and Slovaks from the Carpathians who worked in the mines in Pennsylvania. And you know, I bring home pierogies, and she goes, "Oh, good, hunky food," which was a, you know, a slur, a derogatory term for, you know, people from what was thought of generically as Hungarians, people from
Right.
the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Anyway, hunkies, Polak. I'm a ski myself, so
Yeah.
anyway.
Well, exactly. And the music, you know, is really quite interesting and different from a lot of the other kinds of party music, perhaps. But what really interests me is how different it is from the music that I've been able to find from the interwar years that was recorded you know, in Poland or by people in that Poland, Ukraine sort of area. There was a full recording industry there, but it seems like it concentrated on tangos and you know, some
Brass
sort
bands.
of foxtrots. But not,
Classy
you know.
urban music.
So there's no overlap.
Because these people are hillbillies.
Okay.
They're backwoods folks. They're from the mountains. They're from little villages.
I
And
see.
they're
So they
playing
wouldn't have
stuff from.
able have had the chance to record their music while they were over there.
Precisely. There would have been no interest in the record companies, you know, recording this you know, backwoods stuff. The same is true, I should say, you know, with the Armenians. You know, there would have been very little interest in Constantinople in recording this backwoodsy stuff that Kamenimi Naus is playing, you know, the rural stuff, right?
Huh.
So yeah, so immigrants to the US were given opportunities to record that they would not have had in the homeland very, very often.
I
Okay.
see.
So here's an illustrative important story about that. Now, I have to say, to begin with, a lot of this research was done by Dick Spotswood, Richard K. Spotswood, who is a great researcher and reissuer, discographer of music, who's been very active since the 1960s, is still very active, wonderful guy. And in the 70s, he got fascinated by Ukrainian music in particular and did a bunch of work. And there were people still alive to talk to in the 1970s that aren't around now. And one of the people he got especially interested in was this virtuoso violinist who made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of records, named Paolo Humniak. And Paolo Humniak was this virtuoso who was Ukrainian, but had this vast repertoire. He and his brother had a violin repair shop in the Lower East Side. So the deal is with the American record companies, when they decide that they're going to start recording immigrants, about 1908, 07, therefore, so, you know, right at the peak of the wave of immigration, the very peak, they say, can we get any money off of these immigrants? And so they start first marketing recordings made in the homelands domestically in the US for the immigrant populations. Can we sell them the sounds of back home here? And will that then make them buy record players, right? It kind of works. And they begin by doing it by the largest groups demographically. They actually just go down the list by demo. So it's Germans first. And then it's, you know, Irish and Czechs and, you know, down. And eventually they get around to, you know, Poles and then down, 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 Ukrainians, down, 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 Slovaks, down, down, down. Finally, at the very bottom, you know, it's the middle of the teens before they get around to Armenians and Arabs. You know, they started on, you know, Greeks were first because there were
Right.
just more Greeks. And so anyway, that's the strategy.
Right.
But
But then it sounds
bringing
like
them.
you're also saying that there are these cross-cutting sort of class-based currents that mean that, you know, maybe more rural or more lowbrow kinds of music are able to be recorded, or they turn out to be what can sell in the US that wouldn't have been
Exactly,
able to
right.
be made over there.
Right. So the stuff that they initially market to the immigrants is basically middle class or aspiring middle class kind of music. And it turns out that stuff sells less well than the kind of village music, the kind of rural music from back home that they remember. Stuff from weddings, stuff from parties,
Oh,
songs
yeah.
from home that they actually know, and not the kind of cosmopolitan urban stuff, right? So they begin scouting around for, can we find somebody who plays this stuff? And there was an independent record company called OK Records. who, as a matter of fact, were the people who took a chance on Mamie Smith
Right.
recording Crazy Blues. They were taking some chances, okay. They were kind of the American division of the German Odeon label. But anyway, somebody at OK Records in New York City just walked into a Ukrainian store on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, run by a guy named Myron Cermak, one day. And so this OK Records executive, representative says to Cermak, like, do you know anybody who plays like village music, like back home kind of stuff? And Cermak points to the other side of the room and goes, like, yeah, him, that guy right there, that's who you want. And it's Pelle Humniak, this violin repairman and virtuoso who was classically trained and had this vast repertoire of folk music under his belt and just played his ass off. They said, that's who you want, that's the guy, right? Okay, great. So they go, he records whatever it is, Six Sides or something for OK. Right about that time, OK actually gets bought out by Columbia. Humniak goes back and records for Columbia again. And this time he records a 12-inch disc called Ukrainian Wedding. And what it is you get like a little bit of a skit for like a minute. There's like dialogue of like what would be happening at a wedding, and then you get a song that'd be playing at the wedding, and then you get a little bit more of a skit, what's happening with the mother and the bride and family stuff that going, arguments that are going on and celebrations and the uncle's too drunk, whatever, stuff that happens for fun, at real life at weddings. And it's 4 minutes for the whole side, and you get like three little bits of songs, three little skits,
An
and
entertainment
then it,
package.
right, it's like it's a party on a record.
Ну, good luck, музиканти, заграйте по краєвому. Ой, дружба, я пане, брате, ой, дружба, я дружба. До шлюбоньку не труведу, бо то моя служба. Начинає та ще й на чужині, серце мися розпадає на дві половини.
Гей, дружби, плиз, не тупайте ногами, бо мені чисто фльор завалете.
Ей, місіс, та що весілля?
Не вермай весілля, будете гуляти на гаї.
Отже, молодий прийшов, вже молодий прийшов, грайте марше на добрини для містра молодого і молодої.
And you flip the record over, and it's a continuation more of the same, right? Runaway bestseller. One of the best-selling records in the history of the United States, like 100,000 copies. Crazy. Changes the record business forever. Changes American music forever, right? Runaway bestseller. Now, I should say that Slavs at the time were already into the idea of performing weddings so that there were touring troops who would go around to towns and put on a fake wedding as a show for fun for people. Because weddings are when you get to listen to the most music, have the most fun, dance the most, and get the most drunk.
Tony and Tina's wedding.
It was a Tony and Tina's wedding kind of deal, right? For entertainment. And people get paid, actors doing this, right? Anyway, so this idea that Humniak had of doing this record, every other ethnic group from Eastern Europe, all the different Slavic groups, did their own versions of these records, and they sold like crazy.
It's so fascinating, that you have really interesting and stuff I would not have thought about how America sort of supercharged or changed the nature of the culture for various ethnic groups, but largely because of the hyper capitalism, it sounds like, the decisions were driven by what sold, and it
When the
created
record companies
opportunity.
saw that Poles and Ukrainians would buy records, would continue buying records into the Depression, they deleted all this other foreign language stuff, all this other ethnic stuff. They kept recording the Slovenians, the Slovaks, the Poles, the Ukrainians, because they kept buying records. And that then becomes polka music in the United States, which
Yeah,
continues to be a
and music
huge
that would
culture all
never,
over the Midwest, the East Coast,
yeah.
whatever.
And it wouldn't have been recorded there. It might have sold, you know, to rural populations in the old world, but it seems like the people who made the decisions wouldn't have thought so because of their class prejudices.
Right. And where are they going to get the money for a record player? I mean, they can barely support their children. They can barely live, you know. And plus, there's all this turmoil back home. You know, there's war.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Who's got, you
they
know?
They weren't under pressure to sell the machine like they
yeah,
were
the machine
here.
Is a piece of furniture, and you have to carry it up a mountain to the village. I mean, that's one of the reasons that the music sounds like it does, is because there wasn't a lot of communication between and among the various villages, because you had to carry the instruments up and down mountains from village to village.
Paolo Humeniuk, fiddler from the west of what's now Ukraine to the Lower East Side of Manhattan Island. That was a 1926 performance called Zaruchini, or Engagement Celebration. The first Canary Records release of 2025 is an album of Humeniuk's work from 1926 through 1930 called Garland Weaving. This is Crazy Words, Crazy Tune on Community Radio WRFI. My name is Roger Kimmel Smith, and my guest is the proprietor of Canary Records, Ian Nagoski.
So Paolo Humeniuk was immensely popular and spoke directly to the lives of people who were new to the United States and had been for generations, centuries, living in the highlands. There is something, I think we can say cross-culturally, about people from the highlands, where they tend to be less cosmopolitan. They tend to be more conservative. They tend to retain the old ways because they're not exposed to the music and culture that comes through trade routes. And the music and culture that one then finds consolidated in port cities, right? So you're
Yeah,
not
the opposite
hearing
of that.
stuff, right? So,
Surviving, you know,
yeah,
the
and tending
flows.
to be, tough about it and proud about it.
Yeah.
So the whole thing of hillbilly music from Kentucky and West Virginia, they say, oh, country music comes from that. Well, it just so happens that they had less access to all that other stuff and tended to want to preserve stuff from their ancestors being handed down, who were people, Protestants from Ulster in Northern Ireland. So those songs just get handed down and adapted and modified to whatever instruments were available. Banjos come around, new technology. So they start playing banjos, African technology being introduced up into the mountains where they're, then playing Sears and Roebuck guitars that they can get mail order. And they're playing banjos and, whatever fiddles that they can get their hands on or can make. And that becomes our idea of original country music.
I mean, the similar kinds of narrative arc about how that music got itself recorded and started entering the mainstream that way, you know.
There wasn't access, and there was a cultural predisposition to, God, Guts, and Guns. I mean, that's a real aesthetic criteria for a lot of folks, a lot of parts of the world. There's a Greek singer who I love, Satorios Stazanopoulos, who was
Oh
not
yeah,
from.
that's the one my girlfriend said his voice sounded like baying animals. She
Oh,
couldn't handle him.
fantastic singer, devastating singer. But yeah, real old traditional backwoodsy style singing. And he was not real connected to the other Greek singers in New York City at the time. He was not like connected to the cafe scene, to Marika Papagika and, all these nightclub players, because he's doing stuff from this little village in the Morea in the rural South. And he sticks by it. And it's God, Guts, and Guns. It's old songs from the 19th century when Greece separated from the Ottoman Empire. So it's a lot of what they call kleftika. Klefts were rebel bandits who fought against the Ottoman Empire. So yeah, it's a lot of stuff about killing Turks. It's a lot of, and he was very right wing. He recorded a song in praise of a dictator, Metaxas, late in his life in the 1940s. There's something about being from a port city and having access to lots of different kinds of people with lots of different points of view and backgrounds and all that stuff, and being separate from and outside of those cultural connections that make a huge difference in the kind of art an artist wants to make, the kind of music a musician wants to make.
I remember
So,
the port cities played a key role in Michael Denning's argument in Noise Uprising about the recorded music,
right,
that
bingo.
the new dance musics were being generated in these places through the cross cultural currents.
Right, the intersections. And then, of course, the introduction of sound recording, making it very fast to hear stuff from Uruguay and Argentina that's, becoming popular in Berlin. And then from Berlin goes to, Athens or something,
Yeah, Warsaw, you
So,
know.
yeah. And, we get recordings of the Charleston all over the Middle East, Tehran,
Right. I just came across
Algeria.
one. I think it was on one of your compilations, right? With Madame
Yeah, Madame Blanche, who I think was
Blanche.
Armenian in Tehran, records "Yes, Sir, That's My Baby" in Farsi.
Odeon record, Madame Blanche.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's another one that Chris Silver points out in Morocco, and then there's another one in, oh, I want to say Baghdad.
Incredible. And just for the record, that's on the global compilation of yours called Hearts and Livers. Let me ask this.
I mean, I don't know anything about the, you know, the process of making these old 78s listenable. You know, you do a great job on that. You know, what's the physical process for actually dealing with these pieces of artifact?
Yeah, thanks for saying that. I've been getting better over the years. I started in 2011, really doing my own transfers and restoration. And the process is actually pretty simple. Clean the record first, then get I've just got a DJ turntable, modern DJ, with a needle that's about the right shape and size for the grooves, because 78 grooves are wider than LP grooves, of course. LPs are micro groove records. They were marketed in the 1950s. So you get a wider needle, goes in the groove, you play it at about 78, because they didn't settle on that speed until like 1920. So anything before 1920 could be any number of speeds. You have to kind of figure that out. Then you basically just make a tape recording of it, which I just record it digitally, very high quality onto the computer, take that file, and then begin a process that is a lot like sculpting, where, you know, what a sculptor says is, you know, you make the sculpture just by taking all the stone away that isn't the sculpture. And that's exactly what you do with the sound, is you take away all the sound that isn't the music. And there's software for that that I've been using, and I've gotten rather good at it, if I say so myself. In fact, in the past 6 months, I have improved significantly. It's playing a musical instrument, really, using the software. And I've gotten okay at it over time. I generally put in about 10 minutes for every 1 minute of sound. That's the average. Sometimes three times that or four times that, but that's about it.
Which means at this level of productivity we've been talking about, that's a fair amount of time.
So I'm lucky that right now I don't have to do a lot of drudgery to earn a living, and I can mostly do this and buy and sell records. And that seems to give me enough where if the car breaks down, I can get the car repaired and I'm not late on my bills. Still hand them out.
Decent poverty, you know, that's always been my aspiration.
Exactly. If I'm a footnote in a book and I live a life that seems meaningful enough where I feel that my children will be proud of me, then I'm okay. That's all that matters.
Well, like we were saying before about the market and giving them what they want or not, so to speak, it seems to me we could say
you might be giving what a small number of enlightened subscribers don't know that they want until you provide it and make it available.
I don't know. I watched that Big Star documentary about the, you know, the rock band that never really made it. And Jim Dickinson, the record producer who made Big Star Third, refers to Alex Chilton as an art brat. You know, he kind of grew up in a household where his parents were artistic, and he had an idea of himself as somebody who was making something of lasting artistic value with no particular interest in the marketplace, because he'd seen what the marketplace was by having been in the box tops as a teenager. Anyway, yeah, I'll cop to that. Art brat, you know, like I got a lot of rules. I got a lot of, you know, like I don't sell any merchandise. Like I'm pretty strict about, you know, I do what I do because I want to do it. And I don't have a market in mind. I figure the world will catch up, you know. It's pretty snotty attitude, really. Me and Harry Smith. Harry Smith referred to himself consistently as snotty, and that was his problem. So, you know, I can kind of relate to that sense of not wanting to pander is what I'm saying. I mean, this leads me to another story, if you're interested.
Sure.
You know, another character, a really interesting person, who was from kind of an unlikely background. A woman named Laura Creighton was born in 1899 in Conneaut, Ohio, in a farming family, and was, as a kid, trained as a classical singer. Everybody thought that she was going to be a professional singer when she grew up. But then life kind of took a turn when she was right out of college. She got married to a guy who was a naturalist, an ornithologist. And his name was Rudyard Bolton. And Bolton got a job in Pittsburgh at the museum. The Carnegie folks gave him some money. And he went off on an expedition to Africa, and she went with him about 1930. So she's like, you know, 30 years old, basically. She goes on this African bird hunting expedition. But she likes music. And she starts listening to African music and collecting instruments. He's collecting examples of birds. She's collecting instruments. She's going and listening to songs. She finds out she can really relate to this music and relate to these people. And they come back after a few months, and she tells the newspaper, who are interested, like, oh, what's it like for a, you know, a white woman in the, you know, the wilderness of Africa? And she says, if I didn't think I could go back someday, I wouldn't even want to live. Like, it's so much better there. I was so much happier there. It's fantastic. And so she keeps going back over the next decade, and she starts recording, like a lot, like tens of thousands of recordings, and brings them back and does kind of what I do, goes around and gives talks and explains to people how good African music is, that it is so insanely sophisticated. She says Africans have forgotten more about rhythmic structure than we, white folks, Europeans, Americans, will ever know. It is the way future for all music. To understand Africa and African music is, it's the next important thing for Western civilization. We must deal with the fact that they are just better than we are.
Wow.
She's a visionary going around explaining this with slideshows and films and recordings, proselytizing. Right,
with an ethnographic kind of focus.
Yeah. She attends very 6 months. They wind up, they move to Chicago. She goes to anthropology classes in Chicago for a little while. She begins to develop an idea that, like, I think I'm onto something here, and I think the world needs to hear this. And she begins to proselytize for this material that she's encountering and loves personally. Like, she feels it somehow, right? Okay. So then she's meeting all these, like, big famous composers and conductors, and playing them this stuff and going, like, this is really good, right? And she gets a grant, and they put out a 78 RPM album, a set of discs from her collection of African music.
But this was like a major label package.
RCA Records, 1939, right? And right about then, well, you know, she's 40. And what happens? Her husband leaves her. Age-old story, right? Woman gets to be middle age, her big shot academic husband dumps her.
Right. Well, now that she had big projects of her own.
So in 1969, she wrote an autobiography, a memoir called The Music Hunter, published by Doubleday. Really good book. Nobody reads it anymore. She's very unfashionable now, by the way. She sums up the whole first 30 years of her life in one page. And in the entire book, she doesn't mention his name once. It's like real clear that she doesn't want him any part of the story, right? But she says in the book that she had noticed other friends of hers having their lives change, meaning get divorced, and that they fell apart, and she decides she's not going to do that. So immediately after the, you know, when the divorce happens, she throws herself into another project by going to Mexico to a big conference on Mexican and Native American music. So she attends this conference, and she gets this idea, like, yeah, I think we got something here. I think maybe I could apply the same skill set that she developed in Africa to Indian music in North America. She gets some grant money. She knows some rich people by now. She gets some grant money and she starts recording. One of the first places she's able to record, she has a hotel room immediately across the street from the studio of the painter Diego Rivera.
Oh.
Diego Rivera happens to be separated at the time from his wife, the painter Frida Kahlo, and he happens to have been collecting antique Mexican musical instruments. He's got like, a handful of them there. Very old. 2,000 years old, old. So she goes over and she hangs out at his place. Meanwhile, he's in the process of painting Paulette Godard's portrait, who was then Charlie Chaplin's wife.
All right.
So she winds up producing a couple of sets of records for RCA of her field recordings that she does over the next 6 months of Mexican and Southwestern Indian music. And on this one little track of her demonstrating a, it's you know those little wood frogs with the notches on the back, and you rub a stick across it and it makes a little clackety clack sound that's supposed to be like
Okay.
a croak.
Yeah.
Right. So there's an old stone instrument like that, a friction instrument, where you rub a stick against some notches. So she plays that into her recording machine. And in the meanwhile, in the background, you can hear a guy talking. That's Diego Rivera in the process of painting Paulette Godard. Now, it just so happens that right at that time, there's an assassination attempt on Leon Trotsky.
Oh, yeah, right.
Now, Leon Trotsky had slept with Frida Kahlo.
Right.
So Diego Rivera is under suspicion of having attempted to assassinate Trotsky, and Paulette Godard evacuates him out of the country so he isn't arrested. So now Laura Bolton doesn't have a thing to do because she was hanging out at his place. She goes to a museum, she records there, she starts meeting up with people, guides, she goes around, visits a whole bunch of places around Mexico, New Mexico, Arizona, and recording tribal musics, and finds out that she's really good at it. She can really talk to people about their music, and she likes it. And produces these two sets that come out 1941, when the big American narratives were still, the Indians are the bad guys in every novel and every movie, right?
Oh, forget it.
Right. They're the
Course.
bad guys. Here she is showing America, look at how beautiful and sophisticated this music is that we have in our country. And again, this is this massive musical resource that we have as Americans to offer the world and to introduce into our musical life.
But this is
We
the
get
set
to
that
have this.
you've reissued the American set of Laura Bolton's.
Yes, right, exactly. They're very common. One finds them around all the time. They are field recordings with no artist credits, as was typical of the time.
It does seem like it's some of the earliest, recorded, what shall we call it, tribal, indigenous,
Yeah, American Indian music, yeah. Which
right.
and they follow in a tradition of being educational demonstration records, which was generally how American Indian music was recorded, until Indians themselves began releasing it for themselves. Before that, it was all educational material. There's a very important upstate New York American Indian record made in 1912, two performances in Seneca by a group who were on tour with Wild Bill Hickok as part of a sideshow,
All right.
basically. And there's a funeral lament on one side of the Longhouse religion. And I finally found somebody who said that he spoke enough Seneca that he could understand the words, and he said it's gibberish. They neglected to sing real words because the audience for it, white folks, wouldn't know the difference anyway, and they weren't going to like use sacred texts
it was some
on
jive.
A commercial product. Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful performance, 1912, and it sold like crazy to schools and libraries and institutions as an example of authentic Seneca music. Interesting, right?
Oh, marvelous. Oh, I definitely want to play that. That will serve as my land acknowledgement.
All right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Song of the Seneca People can be found on the compilation disc called No One Cares, International 78 RPM Disc, circa 1912 to 1955, on Ian Nagoski's Canary Records label. Well, Ian, we're approaching the end of our allotted time for this globe-spanning exercise.
I'd love to hear you introduce, you know, the last record you selected for our little playlist, because it's wacky.
This is one of the best-selling records in the history of American music, the history of the record business in America. And it is, and I have said this for a long time, put a gun to my head, it's my favorite record of all time. It's a masterpiece.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so it's called the OK Laughing Record. And if you have to explain it very quickly to somebody, it's a side of a record where for 3 minutes people laugh. But the deal is that it was recorded in Germany in 1920. So right after the First World War. It is a record that is, the premise of it is that a man begins playing a cornet solo where he's playing an old sentimental song from the 19th century and somebody bursts out laughing. Now, why do they burst out laughing? Because the world has gone insane. And all these people have died in the First World War. The world has essentially ended, and you're playing this nostalgic nonsense. And it's absurd. And a person bursts out laughing. And then it makes the trumpet player laugh, and it makes somebody else laugh. And it's this contagion of laughter that erupts. It is, remember, exactly the same time as Dada happens in Germany. So It's a kind of an auditory theater of absurdity. Now, it was released without any of that context in the United States in middle late 1922, and it became the big Christmas present for Christmas 1922 all over America on this little label OK Records. Released anonymously. In fact, we're still not 100% sure who the man and woman laughing are. We know the name Felix Silbers is a trumpet player, the cornet player. It's so deeply human. It's so true to what it is to be a human being and to hear something, receive it, react to it. I've played it hundreds of times for audiences. There are people who hate it and get very uncomfortable, and there are people who laugh right along. I think it's just one of the most extraordinary and wonderful demonstrations of what music can do to affect the core of anybody as a human being. And there were a million knockoffs, well, dozens, let's not exaggerate, Ian. There were many, many knockoffs of this record where people tried to capture lightning in a bottle and do it over again on their own little label using different performers. They also made an OK crying record. Did not sell.
How about that?
This one sold like crazy. Yeah, what do you know? Nobody wants to hear somebody cry. I have two copies. Anyway, and there was a copy of the OK crying record. There was a sneezing record. There was a coughing record. They were trying to figure out, why does everybody want this? And they kept trying to repeat the formula. It wound up massively influential by the generation who heard it growing up. Tex Avery, the cartoon maker, and Spike Jonze both made records derived from, or both, you know, made a cartoon and a record derived from this record. So humor in the 20th century, mm-hmm. by, you know, geniuses, was directly influenced by it. I love it. It's it's a jewel.
And so A Better Cure, A Brief History of the OK Laughing Record, is the album you've managed to put with all this stuff on it. Oh, Ian, what are your thoughts on, me and hopefully other DJs giving these artists more radio airplay than they would ever have gotten in the 1920s or 30s?
Oh, I just can't believe that, anybody has the heart to do what you're doing. I'm very grateful. You know, all of us who are working on this stuff, it's a labor of love and intellectual curiosity and a sense of wanting to share something that matters to us out into the world. And that's just the greatest thing, you know, isn't it? You know, sharing something that matters to you immensely. It's just, it's the best part of being a person. So, you know, we're yeah. brothers in that sense. Yeah.
Wow. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. I really appreciate all the time and listening to me yak it on and, you know, being so engaging.
Say it again, say the subscription URL.
Canary-records.bandcamp.com. I'm very grateful for all of the time and attention.
And thank you for doing
both of those.
You know, my goodness. Thank you on behalf of, the future Aztecs.
All right. Well, anything I can do to help, let me know, okay?
And my sincere thanks to you for listening on Community Radio WRFI. My name is Roger Kimmel Smith, and you can hear both my 2-hour interviews with Ian Nagoski and other specials on my Best of Crazy Words, Crazy Tune page at smithmeaword.com.